morning. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's a few minutes after 9 a.m., February 22nd, 2008. Senator Hoffman will not be joining us today. He's excused. Senator Olson is here. Senator Elk, Senator Thomas, Senator Dyson. This morning, we have four bills up. We're going to make a schedule change. We're going to move the House Bill 61 tax credit for contributions to VOTEC. We're going to move that up to the second bill to be heard. So we're going to lead off here in a few moments with Senate Bill 249, Capstone Avionics Fund and Loans. Then we're going to have a brief at ease while we take down some of the equipment. And then we're going to have House Bill 61, again, the tax credit for contributions to VOTEC. And then we'll go back on schedule to Senate Bill 230, Film Office, Film Production Tax Credit. And then we'll conclude with House Bill 266, Repeal Termination of STEP Program. And if we can have just a brief at ease. Record, I had that scrambled. You have to excuse me here. We're going to take Senate Bill 266, Repeal of Termination of the STEP Program, move that to number two. There are some people that have come in today to testify that are having scheduling difficulties.
226.
Yeah, so we're going to, House Bill 226 will be the second bill up. And then we'll go on to Senate Bill 230 and then Senate Bill 61. I should have read my original notes and we would have, stayed on track. So with that, we're going to go ahead and bring up SB 249, Capstone Avionics Fund and Loans. This is the initial hearing on this bill. The intent here is to hear the bill from the administration. We'll have a presentation on the subject matter, and then we'll take testimony. We'll then set the
fund itself. The bill stipulates we can loan up to 80% of the cost of purchasing and installing the avionics. The interest rate we're looking at is 4% with a maximum term of 10 years. So on kind of an average size project, you're looking at about a $15,000 purchase price, which would give you a $12,000 loan. That works out to payments of about $122 a month or $1480 on an annual basis. Our goal was to provide loan terms that would result in a very manageable repayment plan for aircraft owners, but at the same time, it would provide cash flow to allow us to make loans to future participants to pay for the program and then also to return those monies back to the general fund. We did attach a fiscal note. We're seeking an appropriation of $4.8 million. That would handle about 400 loans in the first year and about 60 loans each year thereafter. As I mentioned, the program will sunset in the year 2020, and at that time, all of the money in the fund plus the earnings that accumulate over time would go back to the general fund. We have asked for two positions to handle the increased workload, a loan officer and a loan closer. We would only fill those positions if loan demand dictates that. We would not ask for any positions in terms of the accounting for this program. We recently installed new software, and we believe that over the next few months we're going to gain some efficiencies there, which will allow us to absorb all of the accounting-related work. So that, Mr. Chairman, is a very quick overview. I'd be certainly happy to answer any questions that you or committee members might have.
Do we have any initial questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I looked at the fiscal note, one of the things that I was wondering that was brought into consideration for it was the savings that the state was going to have related to searches that weren't going to quite be as extensive as they have been in the past with this new program, because many of the searches are actually paid for by the state with the troopers out there that are directing it, as well as some of the search and rescue programs that are in rural, or especially in rural Alaska, that are funded by some of the general funds.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I think you make a very good point, and those numbers are not contained in the fiscal note, but I think there certainly would be some savings in that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomas, and then Senator Elk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see that the fund is established and it's available to individuals, corporations, partnerships, limited liability corporations, limited liability partnerships, et cetera. Do you have a, and I understand the cost is, you know, somewhere in the range of $15,000 to $25,000 per plane, depending on, I guess there's some variables there, but this is intended for small operators, right? This is not Alaska Airlines type thing or anything like that. It's small planes, mostly intended to service that industry. The smaller, even the small carriers, I guess, would qualify, but it's not intended for large carriers to put this type of radar in, for lack of a better term.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, the loan program is set up for commercial operators to have access to use the funds. This could be folks like Hagland, like Warblows, Rust Aviation out of Anchorage, Penn Air. They see the benefit of these avionics, and in some instances, they put them into the airplanes already that they have out in the testbed areas. And my understanding from the Alaska Air Carriers Association is their support of this, that they would like to see those types of 121 carriers be able to utilize this avionics as well.
What did you call those kind of carriers?
It's FAR Part 121. That's Federal Aviation Regulations. It's the commercial air carriers. They have specific requirements set up by federal statute.
I guess my question then is, you know, looking at the cost, I guess the concern is are the funds and the loan going to be more available to the private pilot and those kind of folks versus the larger carriers that may be more able to afford this type of a thing on their own, I guess, is the concern.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, the loan, as I understand it, will be a first come, first serve. So it'll be those applicants, whether they be commercial carriers or the individual private pilots, the access to those funds to use for their desires.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Hill.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, a few questions. Will the loan fund be accessible by people who have already installed the Capstone avionics or whatever the technical term is, who are maybe paying off a loan at a higher percentage rate?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, that's a good question that probably would be determined through the regulation process. In our other programs, for the most part, they're set up for new type loans, although we have some provisions to pay off like interim financing if you have like a short-term note kind of a thing. So that's something that I would say we'd have to deal with through the regulation process.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I mean, I'm assuming that unlike some of the other loan programs that the state has, I'm assuming that the loan will be available to non-Alaska residents. I mean, if they have a plane that is here in Alaska, and I'm thinking of perhaps a big game guide, they have a plane that's here in Alaska, their residence is in Utah or some other state. Are there restrictions on based on residency or just where the plane is?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, basically the eligibility relates to aircraft owners that fly a substantial number of flight hours in Alaska, again, to be determined by regulation, but we're looking at probably around 90% is the number that has been talked about quite a bit. So it's basically geared to where the airplane flies as opposed to where the owner lives.
And that segues into my next question, Mr. Chair. Can you give us any kind of an idea what substantial percentage is? I mean, I'm assuming that the loan program wouldn't be available to somebody that has a Super Cub and flies it 15 hours a year. I mean, what is substantial percent?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, if I understand your question, you're asking what is the substantial number of hours that an airplane would fly in Alaska versus total usage of that aircraft?
I guess I'm asking it in terms of, I mean, what is a substantial percentage of flight hours in the state, and how many people will be knocked out of the program because you've set a criteria that is kind of undefined here in the statute?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, When the FAA looked at the number of aircraft that they felt was a trigger point that they needed to have equipped, it was approximately 4,000. I believe there's about 10,000 aircraft in the state, of which 65 to 7,000 are actually operable aircraft, flight ready. And they elected to choose that trigger point for the 4,000 because those aircraft represented about approximately 90% of the flight hours logged in the state of Alaska. And I believe that on an average basis, that's probably in the 60 hours plus range per year per aircraft on average.
Okay, thank you. And my last question, Mr. Chair. There is a provision that the term of the loan is for 10 years, except for extensions under AS 4433-660. I mean, to keep me from going and looking up the statutory reference here, I mean, is this a relatively easy criteria to meet? I mean, so that people may fairly easily extend the term of the loan beyond 10 years?
Through the chair, Senator Elton. Yeah, basically that provision is set up to so that if we get into a situation where we want to help somebody that's having some payment difficulties, we're not tied into just the 10 years. So it would allow us to maybe go another couple of years and re-amortize the loan if we ran into a situation where they needed some payment assistance.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do we have any other preliminary or initial questions for the bill sponsor? Great, thank you for your presentation. We're now going to go to our list here. Winger? Greg Winger?
He's just here.
Then we'll go on to Mike Stedman. Bring Mr. Stedman up here for his presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Mike Stedman. I'm the Director of Operations for Wings of Alaska and Wings Airways here in Juneau. I'm also the Vice President of the Alaska Air Carriers Association. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 249. I feel I'm representing all Alaskans that travel by small aircraft, including the children and grandchildren of every legislature. The safety benefits of having an aircraft equipped with capstone are invaluable. That's been proven by the reduced accident rate in the YK Delta. It's been reduced by about 48%. Before capstone was available, there was approximately an accident every 29 days in the YK Delta. And the last time, the last period was a 29-month period there between accidents. So it's helped out significantly in that regard. The number one cause of accidents in the state of Alaska is what's known as CFIT, or control flight into terrain. And with the capstone equipment, the pilot is given three of the most important things to him in the cockpit, and that's weather, terrain, and other aircraft. You'll be able to see the aircraft on your screen in front of you. If there's any conflicts, you can also see the terrain that's above you or at the same altitude. And so it enhances situational awareness substantially, and that cannot be stressed enough. When you have this stuff in front of you in the airplane, I'm speaking from about 30 years experience in Southeast Alaska, about 25 years of that without any capstone equipment, and then having the equipment now, it's a tremendous help. It's very, it's invaluable. And I can't stress that enough. With the weather information that you'll be able to get is real time. It's usually, it should be within 5 minutes. You'll be able to pull that up on your screen, and if you say you're doing a flight from Anchorage to Bethel and you do your pre-flight, you get your weather briefing, and then you take off and you're an hour into it, a pilot will be able to pull up the latest weather and have it available to him right there, and he can update that as he's going. So it's it'd be a real good tool. My company was one of the first in Southeast or Phase 2 of Capstone to equip. We currently have 12 airplanes that have the equipment in them. And we fully embrace it as a company. The pilots fully embrace it, and it's been a real good help. So with that, once again, I'd just like to say I fully support Senate Bill 249, and I'd like to see it passed this year. And I do have a little presentation here of the flight following that's available to us as a company, so we can flight follow all of our aircraft. It's also recorded up at Anchorage Center. So if there is an accident, it's very easy to go to Anchorage Center, get the last coordinates of the aircraft, and search, and it's basically it takes a search out of search and rescue, and it's already been proven at least twice in the YK Delta. So I'll go ahead and pull this up on the screen here. So what you see here is basically the entire state of Alaska, and all these little blue triangles are aircraft. And this is real time. This is going on right now as we speak. And you can see that up there in the Bethel area, there's several Hagland aircraft up there, and that's they're identified by the HAGS, it looks like. So what a director of operations or someone with Hagland, if they want to look at a particular flight, they can put their cursor on it. It gives them the longitude and latitude. It gives them the altitude, their heading, and their airspeed. And so by having this longitude and latitude recorded, this is what takes the search out of search and rescue, because you can go right to those last known coordinates and to where the aircraft was last observed. So, and once again, for my particular company, operating down here in Southeast, I don't have any airplanes out there right now because of the fog here in Juneau, but you can see there's a helicopter up in Lynn Canal, and there's another airplane taxiing on the Juneau Airport, which is located right here. There's an airplane out by Pelican, and there's probably a couple down by Ketchikan. So this is it's an invaluable tool, and we embrace this as well, and it really helps us out quite a bit in our flight following, as far as dispatching aircraft. It really gives us a heads up on how far out an airplane is. So the next thing I have is some traffic that will be displayed. This is the PFD is a primary flight display, and I have this Chilton suite here in front of me. And so if there's traffic, it shows up as those green dots, or the green diamonds. You see this one right here. It tells you this guy is at 5 miles ahead of you. He's climbing, and he's at 1,000 feet above you. We have this other guy right in front of us here, and he's at 1,100 feet and probably within a couple miles. And you can see down here in this little box to the right, this box has given us some good awareness of where this traffic is right in front of us with a quick glance, but it's also on the screen as well. And this is the same screen, but it's been blown up a little bit to show you this traffic a little bit better. You can see it's 1,000 feet, and then 5 miles ahead, and climbing at 500 feet a minute. And on this particular shot here, this traffic is at your altitude and 2 miles ahead, and there it's confirmed right here off to the right as well. And on this last one, this is what you would see on your multifunction display. And the traffic here, this is us in this airplane here, and up to the upper left you can see this is traffic here. It's identified right here. This is the altitude. The guy is descending, and at the end of this point here is where this airplane will be in 1 minute. There's also one down below us down here to the lower right. Same thing, altitude, identification, and where he'll be in 1 minute. And this, these different colors, shades of color out here are the train, to give you an idea if the train's at your below your or at your altitude or above you. So, and with that, I'll take any questions you may have.
So, Mr. Stedman, have you experienced in Southeast similar results as up in the Bethel area as far as decrease in accidents and fatalities?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that is the case. The data is still being collected since we are in basically R&D right now in Southeast Phase 2. But I would say that, yes, it has been reduced.
And then is the industry support the amount of allocation that the bill recommends and the timeframe for implementation, or what's the, or do you know if the air carrier group has formulated an opinion on that?
Mr. Chairman, the revolving loan program as is right now is a good start. We need to equip 4,000 airplanes within 5 years to get the full funding from the FAA. And if we can get this revolving loan program through, that'll be a good start and get us going, get a foundation built and get us on our way, so.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure somebody must have put the pencil to the paper. Does that figure out 4,000 planes divided by this amount of money? Does that all work out? It doesn't in mine, but I don't want to admit my ignorance here, so I thought I'd ask the question. When I figured out, it doesn't seem like it comes even close, but you know, even with the repayment over a period of time.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, no, that does not cover 4,000 airplanes. I believe is 90 airplanes the first year. I may be wrong on that, but we do need to get 4,000 airplanes equipped and over a five-year period. So in reality, I think the funding that we're really looking at overall is closer to about $34 million to equip 4,000 airplanes.
Thank you.
What's the federal government's participation? Can you run that by us again?
They've committed $497 million to this point so far, and if we don't equip 4,000 airplanes, I believe $187 million, if I remember right. I believe Jerry Hazlett's on the line with FAA, and he can answer that question a little bit better, but I believe if we don't get 4,000 airplanes equipped within the time frame, then we'll lose about $187 million. And then they may come back in 20 years and finish up with the ground infrastructure. But I believe Jerry's on the line, and I would think that he's with the FAA, and he would be a better person to answer that question correctly.
Mr. Hazlett, is that how you pronounce your name?
Yes, and I'm sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Jerry Hazlett with Federal Aviation Administration. I'm the project manager for Surveillance Broadcast Services and Capstone program there in Alaska, back here in Washington, D.C., and thank you for the opportunity to be here. What Mr. Stedman said is correct. The FAA has stated in a letter from Hank Krakowski, our chief operating officer from the Air Traffic Organization, to Governor Palin, the FAA currently has a commitment of $493 million committed to implementing infrastructure and sustaining that infrastructure out to fiscal year 35. However, as Mr. Stedman mentioned, based on our identified triggers and without the total equipage of approximately 4,000 aircraft, we will only be able to commit to $306 million of that $493. So what's at risk is $187 million of investment in continuing to expand ADS-B coverages and services in the state, as well as additional airport upgrades.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any more questions for Mr. Stedman here? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stedman, how far offshore does this coverage go?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it goes quite a ways. It depends on the altitude of the aircraft. I don't have the service volume right in front of me here to show you that. I know it is available out there, but just from what I've seen, I think it goes, it's probably about 30 miles at least.
Another question, how fast is this data update? I saw your identification out there, and then there's a longitude and latitude, and things are changing pretty quickly. How fast is it update?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it's real time. It's right now. I don't have the exact number as far as seconds are concerned, but it's real time information.
Last question, Mr. Chairman, has to do with the commitment. I know you're part of air carriers, which isn't necessarily made up of the general aviation population. What kind of commitment have you gotten, either from general aviation, or what kind of commitment does Alaska Air Carriers have with the general aviation community?
Through the chair, Senator Olson. The Alaska Airmen's Association has conducted a survey to see how many aircraft owners would equip their aircraft and how much they would be willing to pay for it. Air Carriers has supported that, as well as Alaska Aviation Safety Foundation. They have gotten some good feedback from the owners of aircraft, and Air Carriers fully supports it. We feel that in order to really make everything to work the way it should work, and so that we're all safe, is we need to have the GA guys, or general aviation pilots, the private pilots, need to partake. That way, when we're out there flying, it doesn't distinguish between a commercial flight or a private airplane. An airplane's an airplane, and if you have an airplane coming up behind you doing 150 knots and you're cruising at 100 knots, you can't see behind you, but if he's on the screen, you can see him, and then you can make some adjustments, of course, to avoid a mid-air collision. So with that, in that regard, Air Carrier supports it fully, and we'd like to see GA be a part of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Sidman. This is probably an unfair question, but given that the goal is to get X number of aircraft, get the equipment in X number of aircraft, I mean, does the Air Carriers have a position on whether or not those people, perhaps like your company, that have gone ahead and done this anyway because you see the value in it, does the Aircraft Carriers group have any position on whether or not refinancing should be available, or whether this should, whether the goal should be to add additional aircraft that don't already have the equipment installed in the planes?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, Air Carriers, we're mainly committed to the commercial air carriers, but we do support, like I stated earlier, the GA aspect, because we'd like to have them partake in it, because it'll make the skies that much safer if they do partake. And I'm not sure if I actually answered the question correctly or not, but
so what I'm hearing is that the goal is to get this equipment in as many new planes as possible, and so you don't really have a stand on whether or not those who have been responsible and already installed the equipment should be able to refinance at the 4% rate.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I believe that's correct, yeah, that the more airplanes that are equipped, the better, and there are some that are already equipped. But if we can get 4,000 equipped, that would be terrific.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions, Mr. Stedman?
Last question, Mr. Chairman, has to do with, I guess one of the things I don't see is any letter of support from the Alaska Airmen's Association in here, and that's who we're trying to target as the major GA people that need to be, I guess, enticed into the program. With that in mind, though, and I'm not sure that you are a member of Alaska Airmen's, but with that in mind, do you think if we changed either the loan structure, would that make it more attractive to those people out there that don't fly their aircraft that much, but we're certainly trying to target, whether you either bring the loan up from 80% to a number closer that's closer to 100%, or drop the interest rate on that?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I believe that just from my own surveys of in my own company with my pilots that have their own aircraft, I believe that if we can do something like that, that would be great. It's going to be a really difficult task for us to equip 4,000 airplanes within 5 years. And any incentive that we can do to help the GA pilot will be greatly appreciated, and it will help us immensely, I'm sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I realize that it's very, it's almost prohibitive for general aviation pilots to be able to afford insurance, but is there any reason to expect that the insurance carriers will drop the insurance rates for aircraft that are equipped this way?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I believe what will happen is as the accident rate goes down, our premiums will go down. We've already seen that, and I believe that will continue. The more airplanes that are equipped, our accident rate should keep declining, and our premiums should decline as well.
If I may follow up, Are you inferring then that the carriers won't automatically give a discount for aircraft equipped with this and will only respond to the accident rate?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I really can't answer that question. I'm not sure how the insurance industry will look at it. I just can speak from experience that as the accident rate goes down, then premiums generally do go down as well.
And just a final follow-up, are there any other jurisdictions that are ahead of us in this that we might be able to get information from?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I'm not sure. I can't answer that question.
All right. Sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions, Mr. Stedman? Thank you for your testimony today. We're going to pick up a couple more people, and then we'll come back for that other display.
Okay. Thank you.
Leonard Kirk, are you online?
Good morning. This is Leonard Kirk.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Go ahead and speak to the bill, please.
Yes, I'm with the University of Alaska. There's just a couple points I'd like to speak to here. We've been part of the safety evaluation of the Capstone system out in the YK Delta, where we have, through various independent groups, including MITRE Corporation, NIOSH validated the safety benefits, where we reduced the accident by 48%. The University of Alaska has been involved in the pilot training. As you're aware, we have a statewide campus system. I will be in Southeast Alaska the first half of March doing training. In fact, on the 10th of March, I'll be at the University of Alaska Southeast campus doing more pilot training on the Capstone Avionics. So the University of Alaska has been part of this. We look forward to continue to be part of this program and process and can testify to the safety gains we have from Capstone. During earlier testimony, there's a couple of questions came up that I can address here. There was a question about the service volume, about how far ADS-B reaches. It's approximately 120 nautical miles line of sight. So we had a ground-based transceiver, say, located at Sitka. It would be seeing aircraft 120 miles out over the ocean. So we have a very good range of capability with this equipment. And the information that comes from the ADS-B from the aircraft is updated every 1 second. The universal access transceiver, the technical part of this equipment, was designed to update position, altitude, speed, heading, all that every second. So that answers some earlier questions, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions that I might be able to help with.
Any questions for Mr. Kirk? Okay, thank you, Mr. Kirk, for your testimony. Also from UA, Wilford Ryan.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Finance Committee. My name is Wilford Ryan. I am representing, along with my colleague, Mr. Stedman, the Alaska Air Carriers Association. I'd like to, before I make my formal testimony, I'd like to answer some of the questions that was asked by members of the committee this morning. And I believe, one, does the Alaska Air Carriers Association have a position on the refinancing for commercial aircraft should be available? And our official position is that even though phase two is currently under a research and development program, that in December of 2008, when that program is terminated, we believe that the Southeast Alaska operators should have the opportunity to refinance their equipment when they acquire the depreciated value from the FAA through the Commercial Revolving Loan Program. Another question that was asked was, I think by Senator Olson, was whether or not we have received any support from the Alaska Airmen's Association. And the answer to that question is absolutely positively yes. The Alaska Airmen's Association is a part of the Agreement Information Committee, and they are fully supportive in moving forward with the safety and spending program for the general aviation population. I'd also like to confirm what Mr. Stedman said about the insurance rates pertaining to the avionics equipage. I believe that the Alaska industry is pooled by the insurance company, so any reduction in accidents will be realized with a reduction in. And over the course of the last 7 years since the implementation of the Capstone Phase 1 program from Delta. The industry has realized about a 20% reduction in insurance rates from that time period until now. I believe that Senator Dyson asked a question as to whether or not there was any jurisdiction ahead of Alaska, and the answer to that question is no. Alaska has been on the forefront with research and development for the ADSP program, and as a result of the reduction in accident rates and the tremendous improvement that the new generation equipment has given us, the ADSB equipment is now going nationwide. So currently, we're competing against the rest of the nation in receiving ground-based transceivers, so consequently, we're very excited about moving forward with the Commercial Evolving Loan Program. And I'll now switch from answering those questions to making my formal testimony.
Go ahead, Mr. Ryan.
Okay. I'm representing in my presentation the Alaska Air Carriers Association, the Alaska Airmen's Association, and the Alaska Aviation Safety Foundation. We represent nearly all commercial and general aviation constituents in Alaska and are very pleased to support Governor Palin's announcement concerning the Aviation Safety Initiative, or Senate Bill 249, to help Alaska pilots obtain state-of-the-art capstone avionics. Because more than 90% of Alaska is accessible only by air, and Alaska has the highest aviation accident rate in the nation, an expedited statewide implementation of proven capstone safety technologies is essential for the future of flight safety around Alaska. During a 10-year period from 1997 to 2006, there were 124 fatal aviation crashes in Alaska, an average of one fatal crash every 29 days. These crashes included both private pilots, those who fly as part of their job, either as a commercial pilot, guide, biologist, or another profession. In fact, 60 people working as commercial pilots and another 40 working in other professions lost their lives in aviation accidents in Alaska during this time period. And many of these workers were in mid-career, and their death represents losses both to their family and to society. The National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health has determined, based on the commercial pilot's annual salary, and for all workers in Alaska, there was a total loss in earnings for these 100 workers that exceeded $226 million. So those numbers are astronomical. The FAA and the Alaskan aviation industry collaborated in developing and signed a surveillance and broadcast services capstone statewide plan on August 8, 2007. This plan documents the activities for implementing proven capstone technologies throughout Alaska to increase aviation safety and rural community access in concert with the national implementation approach. Coordinating deployment of FAA ground infrastructure and aircraft avionics equipment is key to an accelerated implementation strategy. The five-year plan includes equipping approximately 400 or 4,000 Alaskan-based aircraft, and those aircraft are comprised of about 1,000 commercial aircraft used in commercial air transportation and roughly 3,000 general aviation aircraft.
Mr. Ryan, could I get you to speak up a little bit and speed up a little bit?
Okay, I'm wrapping up here. The Safety Incentive Program will enable Alaskan operators to install their airborne part of the equipment. Once implementation statewide, the FAA estimates about 33% reduction in fatal accidents statewide, and a more effective search and rescue operations, and a public benefit of about $824 million over the next 27 years. Air carriers and Alaska Airmen, in conjunction with Alaska Aviation Safety Foundation, support Senate Bill 249. I'm available for any questions.
Could you go ahead and email your written comments to the Senate Finance Committee, Senate-Finance-Committee at legis.state.ak.us?
Yes,
sounds like you were reading a testimony, so it'd be probably fairly easy just to email a written testimony to us. We have any questions?
Chairman, I won't do that.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Ryan, the only question that I have, can you think of any other incentives that the state or we in the legislature could use to go ahead and try and entice people to go ahead and subscribe to the program?
Well, it's going to be extremely challenging to bring the General Aviation Group into the incentive program. Research has indicated that the population is only willing to spend about $2,500 to equip their airplane, when in fact the avionics package costs about $12,000. So the airmen currently have about 180 people interested in the program, but we feel that it'd be extremely difficult to attract equipage for the 3,000 general aviation groups unless there's some financial incentive for them to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan, for your testimony. That concludes the off-net testimony. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to come forward and speak to this bill? Seeing none, we have Mr. Stedman come forward. And while he's doing that, we do have referenced earlier in the process the reference to the $4.8 million to capitalize this fund. We are, as the committee members, just as a reminder, working on trying to abolish some of these funds that we've created. We've got a multitude of them. We're trying to close some of these down, so this would actually be opening up another one. And also the $120,000 in the fiscal note for a new loan officer for travel and supplies, I think we'd be taking a good hard look at if that is actually needed or not. But Mr. Stedman, in closing, and before we have a brief at ease so you can show the senators here and people in the audience the magic black box you have right to your left so they can see it in real time, when did your family start flying in Southeast Alaska float planes as push pilots?
1941.
Thank you, Mr. Stedman. We'll stand at ease. come back to order. We'll go ahead and set Senate Bill 249, Capstone Avionics, aside till a further date. And we're going to go on to the next bill, House Bill 266, Repeal Termination of the STEP Program. Again, this is out of sequence a little bit from the public or published record. We've had a change in the schedule here, and I'm looking for, there he is, Rep. Coghill, primary sponsor. If he could come forward, with all that chaos, you might have flown away or something. We'd have Capstone to come find you. If you could go ahead and present your bill, Representative Coghill, and then we'll take testimony on it, and we're going to set this bill aside along with the other two coming up for further information and stuff afterwards. So
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Coghill. I represent District 11, the North Pole area, and House Bill 226. The original intent was to repeal sunset on the STEP program, which is a state training program that is takes 0.1% of the unemployment insurance money, puts it into granting capacity to go into training and retraining of workers within the state. In the House, we put a 2008 deadline on it and some requirements for a report in 2008. It was anticipated, I think, that the bill would go through and that we would have a report this year. Coming through the Senate, they moved that to 2018 and left an annual report in there, which I think is right. So this particular program is meant to take dollars and put them into training, retraining of Alaska workers. I think we've had, since its inception in 1989, about 23,000 or more who have had the benefit of training. It has sometimes fallen into the union, non-union debate, and so you'll see in the reporting section of this particular bill that the review is to look at those entities that are union and non-union, organized or unorganized, and publish a written report containing findings and recommendations. In fact, Mr. Chairman, the Department of Labor Commissioner has already set up a task force to begin that work. I got to tell you, for me personally, I couldn't speak more highly of the present commissioner and his history and reputation in workforce training. So my confidence level is very, very high there. This does take money and put it to those workers who have actually paid in unemployment insurance. With the needs in our society and those of us who are on the table who fit into the baby boomer generation, the next generation and even some in our generation are going to need to be trained and retrained. I think this is one way to do it. This is not the only way. There's the Workforce Development Board that has a broader scope than this, but this does get into those who don't have the wherewithal to get into training and those who need to be retraining. So it kind of fits a segment of society that has a greater need. So I'll let the public testimony be what it is. There is some need, though, I think, of making sure that we treat all workers in Alaska that pay unemployment insurance with giving them some access to programs like these. I know that this commissioner is heading in that direction. I know that it's been used well up to now. There have been some arguments, as you will have, in granting processes. The grant process right now is very complex. It could be streamlined. It has been streamlined this year since we started this discussion. And so my hat's off to the Department of Labor. They've done, I think, a yeoman's job in changing some of the granting procedures. So from my perspective, we should go ahead and extend this out to what the last committee in your body, Mr. Chairman, did, and that was 2018, with an annual report, I think is a good idea. Even though many of us get annual reports that collect dust, this is one I think that will not, because it is one of the undergirding factors in Alaska on how to get both young people and people who are hard to place into workforce. So this program has been effective, and it needs to remain. So it's been reauthorized several times since 1989, and in my view, Mr. Chairman, this is something that we should do on a regular, settled basis. And since it has that UI component of funding source going into it for retraining, it just seems appropriate to me that the program keeps on going. So 2018 fits us into the middle of kind of a new economy in Alaska. Whether we get a pipeline or not, it'll be a new economy. And I think every professional career field, both at the construction level and in the computer level and in every other professional level, needs to have the opportunity for training or retraining. So I think it's a good program. That's been my pitch. I'll try to answer any questions.
A while back, there was an audit on the program, and there was several points that the audit brought up. Are you familiar with that, and have they been resolved? Or
I right now, I'm not prepared. I am aware of the audit, but I'd have to sit down and look at them. But there was some issues on the grant process, and I think this commissioner has already begun the process of not only changing the application process, but the way allocations go. So I think they have been answered, but I am not really prepared to speak to them specifically right now. Probably the department can better than I.
Okay. We can ask them, and we can always bring that back
Sure.
later
date. I'd be glad to study that, Mr. Chairman.
We have any initial questions for the bill sponsor? Okay. Seeing none, Rep. Coghill, would you hang around?
Yes, I'll stick around for questions, yes.
I'd like to go to the administration, bring up Mr. Guy Bell and Mr. David Stone. Figured I'd give you boys the opportunity to move the questions back and forth amongst yourselves when we, and maybe you could start by if you have any information on the old audit issues and how they're being rectified or addressed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Guy Bell. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Stone. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Labor.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman, just a few words. First of all, we would like to thank Representative Coghill for sponsoring House Bill 226. The administration does support House Bill 226 and the continuation and extension of the state training and employment program. We've demonstrated success for over 19 years, and during that time we have served over 23,000 Alaskans. And we do evaluate the program's performance every year through our research and analysis section. And our most recent report indicates that more than 94% of our trainees were employed within 12 months after completing their training. So the program is successfully employing Alaskans. The participants in the program during that training year earned over $71 million in Alaska wages in the year following their training, and that's a 35% increase over their pre-training earnings the year prior to their training. And we are successful in keeping Alaskans in Alaska. Over 90% of those that participated in the program in fiscal year 2003 were still Alaska residents in 2006. So we think that those are some examples of the kinds of success the program is demonstrating. In terms of the ongoing review, we do support the ongoing review, the intent language in House Bill 226 requiring an annual report. Commissioner Bishop has already begun that review process with a private sector group that David Stone is going to be leading. And we know the program needs to be evaluated on a regular basis, and our performance demonstrated to the legislature. and we're committed to doing that. Thank you. Thank
you. You have any questions for the administration? Well, thank you for coming forward. We're going to go to the off-net, pick up Ann Williams.
Good morning.
If you could please identify yourself for the record and who you represent and speak to the
Yes, my name is Ann Williams, and I'm the Human Resources Administrator and Training Coordinator for Clubs Mechanical, Inc. in Anchorage. We oppose House Bill 226 as it's currently written. We feel that unless there are major revisions, we would like to see the STEP program sunset. And I'll tell you our experience with STEP. We were awarded a grant in FY 2006. We partnered with Samson's Electric, and we used what we called the TEAM approach. TEAM stands for The Training Earns Alaskans More. And what our proposal did is it brought two well-established construction contractors together to offer joint job training to approximately 80 underemployed and potentially at-risk construction workers. And that was defined as working less than full-time and or facing seasonal layoffs that traditionally increase UI claims. The TEAM program achieved STEP performance measures by cross-training workers employed less than year-round, allowing them to shift between job roles with the goal of achieving full-time year-round employment, which would then reduce UI claims. Additionally, we provided older workers with training opportunities to extend their careers in the industry through transition into office roles. This allows the lower-level workers who seek additional training through the program to move up into higher-paying job classes, creating more opportunity for younger journeymen and apprentices in the trades. The project vision was to achieve stable employment of a diverse and well-trained local construction force. By stimulating the upward growth pattern in our employees' careers, we feel we can retain our most experienced personnel in key positions in the industry, and then they can pass their skills on to the next generation of apprentices outside the traditional worksite training opportunities. And our success was terrific. We provided training to all the employees that wanted it, and that was over half of our workforce. Here, we trained 45 employees in 16 different areas for a total of 81 trainings. Our pass rate was 90.12%. Our experience with the administration of the program was a different story. The requirements for a private employer were a burden to both the administrator and to our employees. The way the grant was written for FY 2008 precluded us from applying for the grant. The RFP was rewritten in such a way that we could not do any in-house training, a component of our grant program that was one of our many successes. We provided cross-training to employees between the trades to enable them to remain employed during slow periods for their trade. We taught employees how to read blueprints, work on sheet metal layout and fab. We cross-trained in HVAC. We educated employees on a wide variety of various components of mechanical and plumbing systems. The FY 2008 RFP also removed payment for instructor fees. Our employees took classes in OSHA safety, construction CPR and first aid, heating hydronic systems, power boilers, backflow prevention, and more. Some of these classes were held locally at UAA, CompuCom, and Associated General Contractors, while others required out-of-state travel, and two were online courses. All required instructor fees. I don't know how a business can provide training if it is not allowed to train in-house or pay instructor fees. We did our best thinking outside the box, but we couldn't come up with any solution to this. And ironically, it was our initial thinking outside the box that allowed us to be successful with the grant in the first place. To the best of my knowledge, this is one of the few STEP grants awarded directly to private employers. Immediately upon its completion, the grant program was restructured and effectively eliminated the possibility of future private employer funding. It is well understood that the STEP grant program has traditionally provided the vast majority of its training money to unions, while purporting to provide training opportunities to any Alaskan with need. STEP is funded by the unemployment contribution of all Alaskans and should be accessible to all. Unfortunately, given its present structure, it is clear this program is designed to train only a particular special interest group. Unless and until there is a major restructuring of the program to encourage its ready access by the broadest base of employers, we recommend allowing the program to sunset. We ask that you vote against House Bill 226 in its current form.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay. With that, we'll go on to Janine Provost.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the Finance Committee. I am Janine Provo, Grants Manager for the Alaska Laborers Training School, and I've been working here for the past 14 years. My thanks, too, to Representative Coghill. I am in favor of extending STEP funding. We've been using STEP funds since I've been here, and I've seen a tremendous growth in training, and that's all in the construction level industry. We train an average of about 300 people per year through STEP. I wanted to speak about the positive impact of STEP upon the construction industry. Here at Alaska Laborers Training Schools, we help fill a need to see to it that Alaskans statewide have those skills to go to work at Alaskan jobs. In addition to seeing to it that the construction workforce that falls under our purview is equipped to safely and effectively provide service, we also share the goal to decrease the number of outside workers brought into the state in the field. STEP funds here are used to expand the number of classes that we provide each year in building, highway, utility, and specialty construction. We focus on trainings that will prepare or recertify the workforce in this industry. The needs that we use to step for include the cost for student or instructor travel and per diem, classroom books and materials, and the cost for the instructors. Our outreach with this particular union includes not only members of the laborers, but through STEP, we do serve other Alaskans as well. Most of those individuals come from the remote rural areas of Alaska. We get requests every year for training, by and large, from the village councils, and those training requests are centered around planned construction that's slated for their areas. Statistically speaking, an average of 50% or more of our students are part of the minority population, and statewide, upwards of 45% of those served are from areas outside Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Juneau. Our success rate has consistently had no less than 87%. You know, STEP's unique in that it gives back to that part of our population that pay into the system through unemployment contributions, no matter what walk of life they're from. It affords them the opportunity to gain and maintain the skills that they need for their chosen career. And that's about it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
You're absolutely welcome.
That concludes our off-net. We're going to come back in-house and work down the list. Kind of watching the clock. We're trying to be done here by 11, so I'm going to kind of play it by ear and see how long the testimony is and stuff, but try to make it as succinct as possible. Mr. Chris Harmon, if you could come forward, please. And then go ahead and introduce yourself and who you represent for the record, and then go ahead and testify on the bill, please.
Okay. My name is Chris Harmon. I'm an IBEW member. I recently went through the apprenticeship program and was a recipient of the STEP funds. These funds were an essential part of my training. I received commercial driver training. It helped with travel expenses and housing while away from home, which was five different terms of 7 weeks at a time for a total of 8,000 hours of on-the-job training. Without these funds, I may not have been able to complete the apprenticeship. Thanks to these funds, I now have knowledge needed to be a skilled craftsman. I hope to see these see this bill passed, to see these funds continue for further skilled labor training.
Thank you. And IBEW is an acronym. Could you state for the
record? International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Sorry.
Thank you. You have questions for Mr. Harmon? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And where are you from, sir?
I'm from here in Juneau.
You're from here in Juneau.
And was the program structured, you know, when you got into it?
Yeah.
It set so many hours for this?
Yeah, exactly. There's so many hours of on-the-job training per schooling. So it works out to about 2,000 a year, 2,000 hours of on-the-job training a year, and I believe a total of 1,400 hours of training, classroom training.
And overall, how many hours of training combined?
I believe 1,400 was approximate. I can't hold me to those numbers, though.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Mr. Harmon, then, your testimony is that this is very beneficial for you to be able to complete
yes.
apprenticeship program and become a journeyman?
Yes. Paying mortgage here in Juneau and traveling and paying rent in Anchorage while up there for my 7-week term was very helpful.
Thank you. Have any other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have you gone to the Alaska Laborers Training School that was budgeting proposed?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay, one last question, Mr. Chairman. How many people are we affecting with this STEP program?
I can't tell you that. I'm not quite sure. But I believe we have 20-something apprentices here in Juneau, the IBW does. And I believe most of them are recipients of the STEP funds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll bring back the administration to answer questions that we'll left open so we can re-ask them that.
Sure.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Robert Caesar. And Mr. Caesar, if you could put your name on the record and who you represent and then go ahead and testify on the bill.
Yes, Chairman Stedman and committee. My name is Robert Caesar. I'm from Juneau, Alaska. I'm an apprentice electrician in the federally recognized Alaska Joint Electrical Apprenticeship Training Program. I'm also a member of the IBW. I work for Ever Electric here in Juneau currently. I have a home here in Juneau and I'm a single father. My young son has recently had a bone marrow transplant, Alexander Caesar, which some of you may have known. Anyway, it's left me with a little bit of financial burden from the bills and things of that nature, and this STEP grant would have been greatly beneficial to me had I got it this year. However, I didn't. I recently attended the first of my 5 7-week classroom training sessions in Anchorage, October 29th through December 20th of 2007. Due to the administration problems between our training program's grant submittal and the Department of Labor, my class was not able to receive any help from the STEP grant. I understand that others that have attended school in Anchorage from our area have received money to help them, and it has immensely helped them while they have had to maintain two households, which was definitely critical for me. I also have a house in Juneau and a mortgage, and while in Anchorage, had to maintain a second home. I greatly urge you guys to pass House Bill 226 and extend the STEP grant program so that I and my family and others might get that help. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senator Dyson.
Thanks for coming and helping us, and I appreciate the burden you're under. Are you taking time off work to come here this morning?
I am.
And this question is not meant to impeach your testimony here, but did somebody ask you to come and or help you prepare your testimony?
Yes, I of course I'm with the IBW, and it's the International Electrical Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and we are a union, and we do have union meetings, and I was I had talked to some of my brothers, but I've created the testimony also with their help too. But.
And if I may, did a union official ask you to come or suggest it would be helpful?
Suggest, yes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any other questions? Senator L.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Robert referred to this, but I think most of us are familiar with the situation. I mean, this was a story involving his son that was one of the more heroic stories out of my community. And I just want to say we appreciate everything you've been through. Thank you.
I really appreciate all of your help throughout the last couple of years. Kim Elton was very helpful, and quite a few members of the legislature. My mother had worked here on the second floor as a copier, Andrea Caesar, and all of you guys were so helpful. Even though this doesn't have to do with the STEP grant, I appreciate your help, and thank you.
That we're going to go on. I'm a little confused on this list. Tom Bryce. Is it Tom Bryce slash, and then Provost, who already had testified. So, here, Tom, you probably want to come forward and say a few things.
Very quickly, I think Ms. Provost probably covered most of it.
Yourself on the record, though.
My name is Tom Bryce, Alaska District Council Labors, address 710 West 9th, Juneau, Alaska. I was at a meeting. Ms. Provost covered, you know, most of the issues. We're just on record supporting the STEP program.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson,
I do have a question. There was a testimony in the recent or this morning that had to do with that this program was only targeting special interest segment of the population. Can you clear that up for me? How it either does or doesn't?
No, I don't think it targets any particular segment of the population. Well, let me change that, Senator. It targets the people who are accountable for state funds, that want to deliver real training, and want to compete in a process. In that sense, yes, it does target people. In the broader sense, no. The doors are open to anybody who can show that they have a viable accounting system, that showed that they're doing real training. I mean, one of the individuals testifying in Labor and Commerce, Northern Industrial Technologies, this is a non-union outfit that's been very successful through the STEP program. And, you know, for that matter, as a union training program with the laborers, we train both union and non-union individuals.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, sir.
That we're going to ask Ms. Barbara Huff to come forward, please. You could, of course, state your name for the record and then speak to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Barbara Huff-Teknis. I'm Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959. And I would like to go on record thanking the sponsor of House Bill 226 for all of the hard work and effort that he and his staff has put in trying to resolve some of those issues or concerns as the bill has moved through the process. In a brevity of time, I would like to echo the comments of the last two previous speakers, or three previous speakers. But I would like to go on record because we've got Teamsters Local 959, unlike some of the other union training programs out there, we actually have a union and a non-union training, or a nonprofit. Actually, both of ours are nonprofit as well. CEE, Center for Employment Education, is our non-union arm, and we have a Teamster training plan. What we were finding, because our Teamster training plan, like the others, laborers or the IBW, are funded through joint efforts in negotiations with the employers that we have collective bargaining agreements with. So we are also attempting to go outside that area so that we could reach out to other individuals that were not necessarily part of the collective bargaining agreement to further provide that training. Additionally, our tech engineer program, which is a four-year apprentice program for our surveyors, we have done and I guess not to toot our own horn, but sometimes we don't do that enough. We have spent extra time and extra effort reaching out to individuals within the communities around the state to bring them in. What we're finding, because of the six-week training time for that four-year program, the housing has been a major issue in being able to cover those particular expenses. So what we have been successful in doing is utilizing some of those STEP funds in allowing those individuals that are participating in the program, say from an outside village, being able to cover some of those housing expenses. And to move this along, I would like to share our confidence in the program. We do believe that the commissioners stepped back, taken a look. We believe that having a level playing field out there is fair for everybody. And if indeed you've got a training program that you can deliver and deliver individuals into the workforce, whether you're union or non-union, we would like to have that support. I would also add, and I don't know if we had testimony earlier, we are one of three states where the employees actually pay into that unemployment insurance. So the employees definitely should be participating at whatever that level is. Thank you, and we ask for your support.
Thank you for your testimony. We are getting behind the clock here a little bit. We got one more that came in on the line from Anchorage, Rebecca Logan, and if you could please put yourself on record and speak to the bill and make it like a couple minutes, because we're running too far behind on the clock.
Yes, Senator Stedman, I will. This is Rebecca Logan. I'm president of Associated Builders and Contractors of Alaska, and I will be very brief. I hadn't planned on testifying this morning, but listening to the testimony, I think that I would like to point out that the very testimony today gives a good example of the discrepancies that are in the program that really need to be cleaned up before the program is extended out to 2018. You heard a private employer tell you that they are not allowed to use training funds to hire an instructor to train their workers, at the same time that you heard individuals testify that they were allowed to use training funds to pay for travel and housing. And so I think that's just a really clear example of some of the discrepancies that exist in this program. And though we support the program, we strongly urge that there is some cleanup of the program before it's extended out to 2018. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. With that, I'd like to bring it back into the room. Is there anybody else who'd like to come forward and speak to the bill? Okay. I'd like to have Mr. Guy Bell come forward again. Just in closing, Mr. Bell, we're going to set this bill aside here in a moment while we continue to work on it, but could you please briefly address some of the concerns and the and then we are expecting your agency then to get back to us on that old audit. And there's five issues in that audit, one of which is the STEP serves only a portion of eligible people, and you know the laundry list there. But if you could have that prepared so when we have this bill back up at the committee next, everybody at the committee has those responses. But in brief closing, would you like to make a few comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Guy Bell, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Labor and Workforce Development. We do use a competitive process, a grant proposal process to receive and collect applications for STEP grants. And we engage an independent evaluation committee, largely made up of Alaska Workforce Investment Board members. When Deputy Commissioner Stone was with the Alaska Workforce Investment Board, he sat in on a number of evaluation committees. At that time, of course, he was in the private sector. And we have used a number of other Alaska Workforce Investment Board members to evaluate proposals. And frankly, we don't evaluate on a union versus non-union basis. We evaluate on overall quality of proposal. And if you'd like, Mr. Stone can go into that since he sat in on several evaluation committees. In hindsight, because of the kinds of questions that have been raised, we have reviewed and presented to the legislature the distribution of grants over the past several years, union versus non-union, number of trainees, union versus non-union, cost per participant, union versus non-union, and contribution by the training program, union versus non-union, and we have shared that with the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, and Senator Thomas had asked us to provide a letter on that, and we have done so, and that's available to you to look at. So, and, you know, we recognize that we're getting these kinds of criticisms, and we're doing our best to resolve those. I think that in this task force that we're putting together, we would like to engage those who are our critics in joining us to evaluate the structure of our proposals and to be sure that we have a level playing field. And we would welcome that kind of constructive participation. And we do, though, at the bottom line is we try to our best to evaluate objectively, not on any basis of affiliation, but in terms of quality of proposal and the ability to employ Alaskans in higher wage jobs.
Okay, well, thank you. We're definitely getting behind here, so we're going to move on. We have two fiscal notes in the packet. The fiscal notes need some more work. There's not enough analysis done on them, the operating expenses and the change in revenue. So not only will we be asking for a little more information on the bill in general and then addressing the audits, but also addressing the fiscal note. And with that, we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for now. And we're going to move on to the next bill. The last bill of the day, House Bill 61, tax credit for contributions to VOTEC Ed, has been postponed until a future meeting. And we've got the last bill up then today. It's going to be Senate Bill 230, Film Office, Film Production Tax Credit. The intent here is to hear the bill. Testimony and set it aside. We can run over a little bit. I will let Senator Ellis, who is the prime sponsor, who has also other meeting priorities shortly after 11 to try to feel the time so we don't run Senator Ellis short. But if Senator Ellis would like to introduce himself and then walk us through the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good morning. It's good to be with you on this beautiful, sunny Juneau day. For the record, I'm Johnny Ellis, Senate District L, Midtown and Downtown Anchorage. Mr. Chairman, if I've heard it once, I've heard it 1,000 times during my time in the legislature, literally, that we need to do something in this state beyond the oil and gas industry to diversify our state's economy. And Mr. Chairman, when it comes down to it, there aren't a lot of great economic opportunities in the state of Alaska for a bunch of reasons that the state can play a pivotal role in, but I think we found one. So when one comes along, I think we need to jump on it, and that's what this bill is about today. 45 states have active film offices, almost all of which offer some kind of incentive program. 12 states offer transferable tax credits. Many others give direct grants. We're proposing transferable tax credits. Our plan is built off the successes of other states. For example, New Mexico had $1.5 million in film spending in 2001, the year they enacted tax incentives. In 2007, the film industry there spent $476 million in the New Mexico economy. Louisiana had $22.1 million in film spending in 2002, $390 million in 2003, and $721 million in 2004. They had over $1 billion in investment in 2005. Pretty impressive. Louisiana. Films Alaska has lost in recent years that may be of interest to committee members. 30 Days of Night, produced by Columbia Pictures starring Josh Hartnett, a production budget of $32 million. Set in Barrow, filmed in New Zealand. The Proposal, in pre-production by Disney Studios starring Sandra Bullock, set in Sitka, filming in Massachusetts. The Yiddish Policeman's Union, the recent bestseller, some of you have read it, by Michael Chabon, set in Sitka, optioned last week by the Coen brothers. We hope that it will be filmed in Sitka. So there are jobs to be had, there's money to be made, and a great opportunity to promote Alaska. So with that, Mr. Chairman, my staffer, Max Hensley, who's done a great job on this and knows the technical details, can run through the headers of the bill, and then we want to get into the Alaska Film Group's excellent presentation.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, this is your first presentation?
Correct.
To the Finance Committee? That's
correct.
That's correct.
It was your staffer?
Yes.
For the record, my name is Max Hensley, staff to Senator Ellis. Just to briefly go through the text of the bill. Section 1 authorizes the Department of Revenue and Department of Commerce to give tax credits to film producers for qualified spending on qualified projects. This credit is fully transferable and fully divisible. On page 2, the duties of the film office are outlined. It's to promote Alaska as a film location, assist productions, and promote local businesses in the industry, as well as certifying an internship program to help young Alaskans get involved in the industry. The eligibility for the program is outlined from the bottom of page 2 to the middle of page 3. These include $50,000 in minimum spending and approval by the film office. This means that they can't be of certain types of productions are prohibited from receiving monies, including obscene or sexually explicit programming. The application requirements for the incentive are the bottom half of page 3. They'll be required to present to the film office their spending plans, dates, script, and of the production. And once approved, they'll receive a preliminary certificate with an estimate of tax credits, which can be used by the smaller or independent producers as collateral to get funding to make the project a reality. The process for giving the credit is outlined from the bottom of page 3 through page 4. The cost report of the spending will be verified by an independent CPA and submitted to the film office, at which point a credit of 30% on the base qualified spending, as well as a bonus of 10% on Alaska payroll and 2% for spending in rural areas or spending during the winter months to try and diversify the spending that comes into the state. Finally, the outlining of the qualified expenditures takes up pages 5, and that includes the direct costs of the production that are incurred in the state of Alaska, not including spending that takes place elsewhere or marketing or costs that are transferred internally within the company.
Mr. Chairman, I've been almost overwhelmed by the business support, folks, the diverse support all across the state. And that's been worked on with a number of people in the Alaska Film Group, and they are our next presenters, if you so choose. Okay. Thank you.
Before you run off, we've got some questions from your colleagues. Senator Hill.
Thanks. Just two quick ones with no answer needed today, probably. But on page 3, line 7, we're talking about productions not eligible, and one of them is one of the not eligible categories is current events programming, and I don't understand what that term is. For example, I mean, is The Deadliest Catch a current events program? Or I mean, I just don't know what current events means, and it's not defined in the definition section.
We'll get you a specific definition, but we're sports broadcasts and things like that that are topical broadcasts would not be covered for the incentive, but a show like The Deadliest Catch would be. So there's a distinction in the types of productions. Okay.
And then the second question, and this one you may just want to provide some information to the committee. Same page, line 16, talks about another type of production not eligible, and that would be films that the commission determines to be sexually explicit conduct as defined in 18 U.S.C. 2256. I've been told recently that definition in federal law is so broad that there might be a question of whether or not the movie The Guardian, starring Kevin Costner, about Coast Guard rescues off the coast of Alaska, that the definition in federal in the federal code is so broad that it may have disqualified the Guardian. Is there any way you could provide to the committee what that definition is?
Sure, we'll get that for you, but that's the standard that all the other states use to preclude sexually explicit programming or production in their states, to separate between the legitimate productions that they'll pay credits for and the illegitimate that they will not provide. So it's the standard everybody else uses, and it has worked quite well. But we'll provide you more details as well.
Yeah, well, that's reassuring, because I'm assuming if it's a standard everybody else uses, Louisiana wouldn't have been able to get off the tax credits then also. Okay, thank you.
We have, we run off.
Oh. I'm just trying to help you expedite, Mr. Chairman.
I don't think we're going to get done. There's a list here, probably 15 people, and it doesn't look like we're going to have the time to get all the way through this today. Item on line four, the excluded item number four, excuse me, line 11, page three, item number four, a sporting event or sports program. Would that exclude like the dog mushing features or races, or how does that play in? That seems to be a unique niche that Alaska may have.
Mr. Chairman, the definition there is meant to exclude broadcasts of live broadcasts of sporting events. If, say, ESPN is at the Great Alaska Shootout in Anchorage every fall, they have to come to Alaska to broadcast that. There's no reason to further give them a credit to do that, to come here and broadcast those events. If it were a documentary or some other kind of creative programming, it would not be covered.
But if you wanted to have a special credit for sled dog races, we'd be happy to consider that. Might be a good idea to promote the state. I mean, this is all about making money, creating jobs, and promoting the great state of Alaska and our unique place in the world, because it's all about tourism and bringing those folks back to see the state. So if we can see some synergies between those things, that would be terrific. We'll work with you in any way you want.
Any other questions on the table?
Mr. Chairman, I'm hoping we can get to the folks who've come into town at great expense. Great.
I think we're going to run out of time, it looks like, for a lot of the off-nets, because there's so many of them. But the next is a presentation. And if you could go ahead and put yourself on the record and who you represent, along with, and then go ahead and do your presentation.
All right, thank you.
I'm ready.
I'd like to thank the chairman and the committee members. My name is Bob Crockett. I'm a current board member of the Alaska Film Group.
And good morning, Senator Stedman and members of the committee. My name is Deborah Schilt. I'm a founding member of the Alaska Film Group and a current board member.
And I'm Kate Tessar, the pro bono lobbyist for the Alaska Film Group.
Pro bono, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
We're here to represent the Alaska Film Group and talk about Senate Bill 230 and what it can do for the state of Alaska. The Alaska Film Group, formed in 1992, is a nonprofit trade association with a diverse membership base, a voice for the film and video industry of Alaska, advocates to create economic opportunities and jobs for our members in Alaska businesses. AFG goals and the state's goals are the same. Progress, productivity, putting Alaskans to work. In that regard, we're here to present Alaska's next gold rush, SB 230. Most people don't realize how broad an economic impact any given production can bring to the state. This is a multi-billion dollar global industry.
Senate Bill 230 uses similar components of other successful incentive programs from states like Louisiana and New Mexico. It uses a qualified ground spend from production companies shooting here for a transferable tax credit for corporate Alaskan taxpayers, not unlike the current PPT. This is a short list of the people and the businesses that film companies use. This is who they hire and where they spend their money. Alaska is no longer competitive in this multi-billion dollar global industry. We're one of only a few states in the U.S. without an incentive program. The first thing a production company asks about are incentives. If you don't have them, they walk away. The film industry can impact communities across Alaska, and many will leave infrastructure for future productions, such as studios, sound stages, and movie sets.
tax credit incentives and how they work. The production company applies for a credit. The film office approves production, issues a preliminary certificate with estimated credit amount, which the company can use as collateral for loans, financing, etc. The movie gets made. The production company submits a spending report verified by DCCED and an independent CPA. The film office issues a transferable tax credit. The producer sells the credit to an Alaska corporate taxpayer, generally through a broker, and the taxpayer redeems the transferable credit to offset tax liability any time in the future. Let's take a look at some of the economic impacts. Remember Northern Exposure? It put Roslyn, Washington on the map. Early network promos for the series showed a sign that read Sicily, Alaska, population 839. The number was an inside joke. It actually referred to the $839,000 allotted each episode, and it was a low-budget series. In spite of their low budget, it cost over $92 million to produce in its four-year run. At an estimated ground spend of 75%, that put over $69 million into Washington's economy.
Canada has been our biggest competitor. From 2001 to 2005, 142 features were produced in Canada. They built an infrastructure around the film industry, and they're so booked with productions, they don't have enough crew to meet the demand. Who do we compete with nationally? The Guardian, starring Kevin Costner and Ashton Kutcher, was set in Alaska, but it only shot 1 week here. All the rest was shot in Louisiana and South Carolina. Why? Louisiana created an incentive program. And the result? In just 2 years, film jobs went from 5,000 to an additional 13,445 jobs. Production dollars went from $7 million in annual ground spend to over $340 million. In 2007, Louisiana had three television series and 34 features. Since 2001, Louisiana and New Mexico have experienced a compound annual employment growth of 23% per year.
What is our current market share of this multi-billion dollar global industry? We're seeing some reasonable exposure to the state with a reality-based show, Deadliest Catch. This is a non-scripted TV series, currently in their third successful season. They have a crew of about 30, but only two are Alaskans. Their per-season ground spend is $3.7 million. We missed out on the series Men in Trees. This episodic TV series has a ground spend of $20 million per season and is currently shot in Vancouver, B.C. Features have the highest ground spend, about 75% of a film's total budget. A recent feature we lost was 30 Days of Night, set in Barrow, but shot thousands of miles away in New Zealand with an estimated ground spend of $37.5 million. These are projects Senate Bill 230 will target. We are currently vying to be the location for an upcoming Disney film starring Sandra Bullock, set in Sitka, Alaska. But where is it being shot?
Welcome to Sitka, Massachusetts. The producers would love to shoot in Alaska, but Massachusetts has an incentive policy in place and we don't. And it's not the first time. Alaska's long been a popular setting for films and television. Just look at our track record of the ones that got away. All of these films were set in Alaska, but which ones actually shot here and were truly made in Alaska?
As you can see at the top of this chart are feature films producing a greater economic impact to Alaska. On average, this is what film projects spend per shoot day in any given location. These are high-paying jobs and compared to the North Slope. Feature films pay high union rates, commercials pay even higher.
This is the film dynamic. Incentives attract films, which in turn affect markets, which help build infrastructure that employs a larger labor force, and so the cycle grows. We have the mystique, we have the backdrops, we have the crew, and we have no state sales tax. What we don't have is an incentive program to bring them here. We're getting calls from film producers wanting to bring their productions to Alaska. You've all heard the recent buzz about the Coen brothers wanting to bring their next project to Sitka.
Passage of Senate Bill 230 creates jobs, diversifies the economy, stimulates tourism, builds infrastructure and support services, offers opportunities for rural Alaska, promotes educational and internship programs, provides transferable tax credits for Alaskan corporations. I think you get the point.
The governor said, as Alaskans, we all have the same goals in mind for our state: progress, productivity, and putting Alaskans to work. This legislation will do exactly that. Please support Senate Bill 230, and thank you for your time this morning.
Do we have any questions? Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I understand it, it's 30% of the credits that are eligible. So if there were $10 million spent in Alaska, and of which $1 million of that was wages, 10%, is that, am I?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, it would be 30% of the total allowable spend in Alaska. So your question was how much was spent in Alaska?
No, I'm just trying to get, so 30% of the $10 million. So
30% of the $10 million, and then if there's another $1 million that's spent on local wages, 10% of that $1 million, that would be another $100,000.
So in that case, $3,100,000 of tax credits that would be sold potentially by that film company to somebody else. Okay. I just wanted to make sure I was, thank you.
As the clock ticks away here, what we'll do, we're going to go on for a few more minutes. I'm going to ask Mr. Dan Stickle from the Department of Revenue to come on here in a minute. But we'll be setting this bill aside. I'll get with the bill sponsor on a schedule for next week to bring it back so there's ample notification. There's quite a list of people that want to testify online so they can have the opportunity to do that. And so the folks that are waiting on the off-net, it doesn't look like we're going to get there at all because we're just about out of time here today. But Mr. Dan Stickle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is he off? Excuse me.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, members
there
of the committee.
Are.
For the record, my name is Dan Stickle. I'm an economist with the Department of Revenue. I'm available to answer questions.
Tell us if this is good or bad. Tell us how the tax credit works and what the tax credit goes against, because we have a multitude of taxes.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The department does not have an official position on the bill. The credit, I think the rates of the credit have been outlined. 30% of eligible production expenditures, an additional 10% of Alaska wages, additional 2% for off-season filming, additional 2% for rural spending. So basically this tax credit would be available to the production companies that do the production in the state. Most of those, from our understanding, are limited liability corporations, which under state law are not subject to corporate income taxation. So we see that this will generally be a subsidy of the film industry. And as far as the amount of the credits that will be given out, that's really hard to say. It depends on the success of the credit program. If we attract dozens of feature films, the impact could be quite large.
Could you explain, if, as an example, there's a $100 credit generated. What does the $100 credit go against?
The credit would be applicable to the corporate income tax. So the company that incurs the production expenses, which would presumably be, in general, a limited liability corporation, it could be another type of corporate structure, but they would then, if they don't have the corporate income tax liability, they would sell it to a company that does. So the production company would sell that credit to a company that has a corporate income tax liability in the state, and it would reduce their liability.
When we dealt with credits on the oil basin, trying to stimulate that, we put limits on a lot of the credits, and specifically targeted. Is there any limits on these credits?
Mr. Chairman, in the bill, there is not.
Do we have any other questions for the department here, Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, I was wondering, there's pretty large numbers there. Is there any way to validate those numbers to see if it's going to indeed make a difference here in the Alaskan economy?
Senator Olson, through the chair, from our I don't think that our department is the best to speak to that. I think Department of Commerce or the Film Group would be better apt to speak to the impact that this could have on investment in the state.
The last question, Mr. Chairman, when you were dealing with tax credits and other tax credits have been given out to different entities, have those for the most part, have those tax credits been a successful endeavor by the state?
Senator Olson, I'm through the chair, I'm really not prepared to speak to specific credits. If you have a specific credit, we'd be happy to look into that credit and get back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the fiscal note here, is this similar to budgeting for some other entities or other parts of the department that deal with mining, fisheries, timber promotion, that type of thing? Is a similar amount of money expended or fiscal note for those ongoing operations, or do you know off the top of your head?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, at the Department of Revenue, we anticipate that we can take care of our obligations using existing resources. I believe the expenditures shown to implement this bill, there were some expenditures, about $300,000 annually in the Department of Commerce.
Right. Okay.
And I'm not sure how that relates to
the others.
Their other spending for other resources.
Okay. Thank you.
A credit works different than an expense. Can you explain to the committee what the difference is, and you can use $100 as an example.
Sure, Senator, Mr. Chairman. The credit, an expense against an income tax, if you had a $100 expense, it would reduce your net income by $100, and that's the amount that that your tax rate, in this case the highest marginal tax rate is 9.4%, it would reduce your net income that the tax rate applies to. A credit applies directly to your tax liability, so if we have a $100 credit, that's going to reduce state revenue collections on the corporate income tax by $100 versus an expense that would reduce their net income that gets apportioned to Alaska by $100. So a credit's going to have a much larger effect on revenues than an expense.
And when we have roughly 9.5% corporate income tax, there's a substantial difference between the ability to deduct it or take it as a credit, the credit being much more powerful by over 10 times.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, we're out of time. It looks like, I was just handed in a note here, and I forgot, on Thursday we have bills previously heard scheduled. So let's tentatively target this for Thursday to bring it back up and finish up our testimony. And I will get with the bill sponsor to double check to make sure that fits his schedule and other people's schedule. So tentatively we'll target this bill back at the committee on Thursday. Meeting adjourned.